evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very good pleasure to welcome today to the university this evening to deliver the inaugural lecture in our distinguished lecture series. As many of you know, today is one of the most distinguished academic lawyers in the country and is known particularly for his expertise in constitutional law and civil liberties. I today read today's curriculum vitae and biography with great interest. I would assure him that if he wished to apply for one of the vacant positions I currently have, he will also be delighted to sign in. The bulk of his career has been spent at the University of Cambridge and his college, Emmanuel College, where he's now a life fellow. However, he spent between 4 and 5 years at the University of Nottingham, where he met his wife, and 2 years at Keble College, Oxford. Personally, I've known Sir David since the mid-80s, when he became president of Wolfson College, at a time when he was the Rouse Ball Professor of English Law. He brought his own special style to the college, which laid the foundation for him to become one of the leading postgraduate colleges in the University of Cambridge. And I'm delighted that we are both honorary fellows of the college. A measure of the esteem that his students had for him was that he was often referred to simply as DGT. And his friends of mine cite their tutorials and lectures with DGT as one of the high points of their course. He became Vice Chancellor of the University of Cambridge in 1989 and was instrumental in implementing changes that have ensured that the University of Cambridge is now a true global force in the university network. People who know Sir David only talk about him warmly and with affection. His good friend Colin Campbell, who fortunately cannot be here tonight, describes him as an extravagantly fine man. He is one of the few academics who I can honestly say that I've never heard a bad word said about him. This is not a distinction I share with him. I will, of course, check this with his wife, Sheila. Probably his only failing is that indeed he is a lawyer, and we know what they can be like. And I recall him telling me that when you read the headstone of a lawyer which says, "Here lies a true and honest man," you must assume that they are now burying them too deep. The Nottingham Law School is delighted to host this evening event. NLS is the largest full-service university law school in the UK, and is preeminent in its LPC provision and the bar vocational course, and has an excellent undergraduate professional provision. So ladies and gentlemen, with that very brief introduction, I would like to invite Sir David to deliver his lecture, Public Order and Freedom of Expression.
Lord Lieutenant, Deputy Lord Mayor, Vice Chancellor, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, it is indeed a pleasure to be back in Nottingham, and I am grateful to the Vice Chancellor, Professor Neil Coleman, for the invitation to speak at the Nottingham Law School. I spent 5 happy years teaching at the University of Nottingham, 1958 to 1963, inspired by that great legal scholar, Professor J.C. Smith, and during my time in the city, I met my wife, Sally. We were married at Castlegate Congregational Church, and our first child, a daughter, was born at the city hospital. Indeed, our daughter was later to become a solicitor after taking what is now the legal practice course for which Nottingham Law School is now. I'm well aware that the subject of the lecture could be enormously detailed and extensive, covering statute law and common law affecting the powers, duties, and responsibilities of those responsible for law enforcement, and implicitly or explicitly touching on the position of protesters, marshals, demonstrators, and the like. My principal concentration will be on the common law, that is, non-statutory not least because there have been a number of recent cases, including one scheduled to emerge from the House of Lords at any moment, though it is often the position, obviously, that statute and common law are unavoidably linked. Final preliminary comment is that in the extensive reading which was necessary in the preparation of this lecture, I was astonished by the developments in the law of public order in recent years. In the past, from 1962 onwards, I had felt some measure of confidence in exploring issues and writing about issues of public order and freedom of expression. No more, and I ask your indulgence in advance for the tentativeness of some of my views. You'll perhaps forgive me if I start in a substantive sense by referring to a famous decision of the Supreme Court of the United States in the area of freedom of expression, though not directly related to public order. This was Near against Minnesota in 1931. The story of the case has been vividly described in a book entitled Minnesota Rag, published in 1981, written by Fred W. Friendly, one of the leading characters, incidentally, in the film of 2005, Good Night and Good Luck, which was about the clash in 1934 between the great broadcaster Ed Murrow and Senator Joseph McCarthy. In response to particular instances of muckraking journalism, the state legislature of Minnesota had enacted a law known as the Public Nuisance Act 1925, which permitted a judge, without jury, to enjoin a newspaper or magazine from publication if it was considered to be malicious, scandalous, and defamatory. The statute was called into operation in 1927 against a weekly paper called the Saturday Express, owned by two people, one of whom, J. M. Near, who, while anxious to hit out at racketeering and political corruption, was also, and I quote, anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic, anti-black, and anti-labor. He and his colleague challenged the constitutionality of the 1925 statute under the state and federal constitutions, but they achieved no success until the battle continued before the Supreme Court of the United States. By 5-4, the Supreme Court ruled that the statute was unconstitutional, as contrary to the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, applying liberty of the press and freedom of speech under the First Amendment to the states of the Union. Chief Justice Hughes, speaking for the majority in the Supreme Court, was well aware that the Saturday Press was a vicious little scandal sheet, and its campaigns had been aimed chiefly at city officials of Jewish origin in the twin cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. The case, however, raised, as he put it, questions of grave importance, transcending the local interests involved in the particular action. And he stressed that the liberty of the press has meant principally, although not exclusively, immunity from previous restraints or censorship. That there is a common law, as well as a constitutional despite of prior restraint, a concept which I will return, was emphasized years later by Lord Denning, when, characteristically in strong dissent, referred to the European Convention on Human Rights to our friends in the United States, co-heirs with us of Blackstone, and to what he called a classic case of Near and Minnesota. However, the fact that Near and Minnesota was only a 5-4 ruling underlines the difficulties which arise over freedom of expression, not least when legislators seek to change the law. Near and Minnesota came immediately to mind when, on arriving after a week abroad at London Heathrow on November the 11th, I spotted a headline in the Times saying, "Race hate laws to be changed after BNP, the British National Party, case failed." In the the aftermath of the acquittal of the leader and another member of the British National Party of incitement to racial hatred through attacks on Islam, there were calls for new legislation to counter further attacks of that or a similar nature. In other words, Parliament might be called upon to respond to the challenge to alleged racism, much as the legislature of Minnesota responded in 1925 to the challenge of irresponsible muckraking journalism. What is at stake is not the specific issue of prior restraint raised in the year of Minnesota, but the readiness of ministers to seek new legislation to counter one perceived another. To urge caution and restraint is not to endorse the views of those whose conduct has stimulated cruelties of legislation. It might be recalled that Lord Oliver said during the spycatcher litigation of the late 1980s that liberty may and sometimes is harnessed to the carriage of liars or charlatans, but that cannot be if their liberty is to be preserved. And that Justice Frankfurter once said of the Supreme Court of the United States that it's a fair summary of history to say that the safeguards of liberty have frequently been forged in controversies involving not very nice people. The offense of incitement to racial hatred, originally introduced in the Race Relations Act 1965, belongs explicitly to the area of public order and freedom of expression. Proposals for such legislation led to long battles in and outside Parliament about the scope of free speech, and it's again worth recalling that legislation relevant to public order had historically been relatively slight. Those attempting to outline the law of public order before 1965 would have cited old common law offences such as riot and sedition, some statutory crimes of incitement which emerged in response to particular attempts to undermine the loyalty of the armed forces or the police. One major statute, the Public Order Act 1936, enacted at a time of fascism and other political activity in the country. A few offences frequently invoked, such as obstruction of the highway and obstructing the police in the execution of their duty, raising issues of police discretion along the way, and a line of leading cases which raised issues of balance between public order and freedom of expression. In the last 20 years, and this accounts for my immediate response of getting back to London Airport the other day, there has been a dramatic change initiated by a revamped Public Order Act of 1986, which adopted and redefined major offences such as riot and unlawful assembly, defined and extended the familiar statutory offence of threatening abusive or insulting words or behaviour, and extended the law and procedures relating to processions. There were some additional provisions directed at recent problems arising from football hooliganism and peace conflicts. And in separate legislation of 1986, Section 43 of the Education No. 2 Act, Parliament legislated rather awkwardly for freedom of speech in universities, polytechnics, and colleges. Then there came the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act 1994, which added to earlier legislation by, for example, seeking to counter entry onto private land by animal rights activists, environmental objectors, unauthorized cameras, and those organizing raids. The Protection from Harassment Act 1997, later amended by the Serious Organized Crime and Police Act 2005, was directed against threats and intimidation adopted in particular campaigns. And the 2005 statute also severely limits demonstrations within 1 kilometer of Parliament. There has been other legislation as well, but much of the law associated with the past traditional ideas of freedom of assembly have been overshadowed by extensive legislation on terrorism. First, there was the Terrorism Act 2000, 129 sections and 8 chapters. The definition of terrorism in the 2000 Act carried over into the Act of 2001 is very vague, and it could be employed, as I have argued elsewhere, in theory, to encompass the actions of those involved in industrial disputes, political processions, religious demonstrations, animal rights protests, and a variety of other public meetings in circumstances where the ordinary criminal law has hitherto supplied. In 2005, there came the Prevention of Terrorism Act, which, after the ruling by the House of Lords against discriminatory detention in the Belmarsh case, allowed for control orders, which in their turn meant trouble in the courts. And most recently, we have the Terrorism Act 2006, creating several new offences. Finally, in that no man's land between anti-terrorism laws and the laws of public order, there is the Racial and Religious Hatred Act 2006, which has injected into the Public Order Act 1986 a new offence of incitement to religious hatred, which will sit alongside but not be parallel to the offence of inciting racial hatred. This incursion into religious hatred brings us back to the acquittal of the members of the British National Party earlier this month. In an illuminating article on the new offence of inciting religious hatred, Ivan Hare stresses in an article in Public Law that it will be confined to threatening words or behaviour and not to abusive or insulting words or behaviour, that the perpetrator must have intended to stir up religious hatred, and that the statute rules out criticism or expressions of antipathy, dislike, ridicule, insult, or abuse of particular religions or the beliefs or practices of their adherents. From the standpoint of freedom of expression, the new offence, even with the special limitations noted, is perhaps especially unsatisfactory when one takes into account the overwhelming problem of uncertainty. Religious hatred is described in the statute as hatred against a group of persons defined by reference to religious belief or lack of religious belief, but no definition of religious belief is attempted. By comparison, racial hatred, despite obvious borderline difficulties, is more satisfactorily defined. Yet the government seized on incitement to religious hatred as one of the initial provisions in the post 9/11 Anti-Terrorism Crime and Security Bill 2001, only to be obliged to drop it in the course of parliamentary proceedings. Later, the desirability of its readoption was considered by the Select Committee of the House of Lords, which reported inconclusively in April 2003 on religious offences in England and Wales. That became the government, however, and a full-blown offence of incitement to religious hatred was injected into the Serious Organised Crime and Police Bill 2005, only to be dropped once again ahead of the general election. And finally, we have the severely restricted offence, which is still by no means satisfactory, in the Racial and Religious Hatred Act 2005. It is a sad story. The issues of public order and freedom of assembly are, of course, in many ways very different from the problems of the 19th century, and there are inevitable problems for justice. The opportunities for the communication of ideas or for the staging of protests were much more limited than 200 years ago, and the response of the authorities was dictated by the limited realm, especially outside London, of the slowly evolving police forces, and ultimately by greater reliance on the military in the enforcement of law and order. Without dwelling on events such as the so-called Peterloo Massacre of 1819 or the Merthyr Riots of 1831, when there were many casualties in the face of military intervention, reference could be made to the disturbances at Featherstone in 1893, when the troops guarding Acton Hall Colliery during an industrial dispute, opened fire, and two people were killed. A special commission headed by Lord Byrne investigated and reported on the events. Troops continued to be involved well into the 20th century. At Celeste in August 1911, for instance, lives were lost when troops opened fire during a railway strike. And the calling in of troops at Heathrow in 1974, admittedly subject to the overall direction of the police to combat possible terrorism, underlines the standby role of the military today. Events in Northern Ireland for over 30 years are a striking reminder of the role of the military. In 1969, the governments in London and Belfast were looking as a matter of urgency at the constitutional implications of calling in the army in aid of the civil war. And some 3 years later, the Wintry Tribunal was in the wake of the deaths in Londonderry on the so-called Bloody Sunday to examine the circumstances in which troops opened fire in the face of a large demonstration. An exercise which had been repeated by the Savile Tribunal's inquiry into the same Bloody Sunday has lasted since early 1998 and has yet not produced its report. The picture is even more complicated when recognizes the interface between public disorder and terrorism in exceptional circumstances. No longer is it possible to assert without qualification, as an official inquiry did in 1975, that the maintenance of public order is the job of ordinary policemen operating without firearms, without special equipment, but enjoying the support and, if necessary, the cooperation of the general public. In looking back to the general picture in the 19th century, however, there are other striking differences to take into account. The mass newspaper market was yet to be created. There was no radio, television, or internet. Telephone communication was in its infancy in the later years of the 19th century. Mobility was restricted, and many people rarely strayed from their own towns or neighborhoods. It could be argued that freedom of assembly is all the more important for people who have no other means of communication. But equally, it could be argued that freedom of assembly and the right to protest are still important in a society where events could be invented, ignored, embellished, or distorted by the press or other media of communication. Indeed, a rapid survey of some of the recent cases or events in the context of public order suggests a wide variety of protests and would respond to protests, making it difficult at first sight to put forward an overall acceptable set of principles or guidelines. The recent cases and events have raised issues of common law and statute law. The common law issues, that is, the non-statutory issues, in a sense, are especially difficult, since they provide the backdrop for so much activity. In the case of Moss and McLachlan, arising from the miner strike of 1984, police preventive action was upheld when a convoy of cars conveying striking miners was prevented from proceeding to collieries some miles away. Mr. Justice Skinner said that the conditions for reasonable preventive action such as that taken exists only if the police honestly and reasonably form the opinion that there is a real risk of a breach of the peace in the sense that it is in close proximity, both in place and in time. The court took a general view of the concept of proximity. And I might add here, as David Pilgrim pointed out in his comprehensive study of civil liberties and human rights, that in 1984 there were many cases which were not litigated, in which the police exceeded their powers by stopping people so far away from the city that it could not even arguably have been a proper exercise of their power or a reasonable exercise of their discretion. For example, at one stage in March 1984, Kent miners and all who looked like miners were stopped at the Dartmouth Tunnel if the police thought that they were heading towards the Nottinghamshire, Derbyshire or Yorkshire colonies. In a later case, much more recent case, there was a court case involving an action against the Chief Constable of Gloucestershire. Police in Gloucestershire had stopped some coaches which had come from London with those on board intent on demonstrating against the Iraq war at RAF airport in the country. The Court of Appeal, with regard to one coach, ruled that the police had on the facts reasonably anticipated a breach of the peace, but had then acted wrongly in sending the coaches back to London under police escort without stopping or leaving the motorway, so that for 2.5 hours after that operation began, there were no toilet facilities available for the passengers and they were not allowed any sustenance. Both sides, the police and the protesters, and incidentally it's not just the Chief Constable Gloucestershire, but several chief councils were involved, have appealed to the House of Lords. The hearing took place a few weeks ago, and it's undoubted that the balance between public order and freedom of expression will have to be examined in some detail. A ruling should appear soon, and I certainly expect the case to be reported, at least in the press, before Christmas. Now, those two cases, particularly Austin and Flashman in the court case, on the common law powers of the police, one decided well before the enactment of the Human Rights Act of 1998, and the other launched after the Human Rights Act had come into effect, showed something of the vagueness and uncertainty of the legal position. In a review of public order law in 1985, the then government took the view that there was no need for codification of common law power. In part, I should perhaps have added, I read it in the document a little too fast after the report case, that the other comparable cases are on appeal at the moment, apart from the courts. In March 2005, when Mr. Justice Turkinder held that at May Day protest in 2001, the police had acted reasonably in surrounding and holding some 3,000 people for many hours in Oxford Circus. This was the 10th case being brought, the Austin and Saxby case. And the ruling will be considered by the Court of Appeal early in 2007. And the scope and application of Article 5 of the European Convention on Liberty and Fair Trial are likely to be central to the outcome. Note once again, however, considerable delay between the actual events occurring In a review of public order law, as I just mentioned, in 1985, the government took the view there was no need for codification of common law, in part because there is advantage in the flexibility of common law, which are defined and controlled by the courts. Notice that advantage of the flexibility, but in his report on the list of disorders in 1985, Lord Scarman commented on a degree of uncertainty in the case law relating to the duty of the police in, for instance, moving people on or dispersing a crowd to prevent or quell disorder. What is clear is that reasonable apprehension of a breach of the peace is not enough in itself. The resulting action taken by the police also has to be accepted on a standard of reasonableness or proportionality. And this was critical in the LaPorte case. In the Brixton report, Lord Scarman referred to various older cases where the resulting action taken by the police was crucial. One of these, the Irish case of Humphreys and Connacht, decided in 1864. The plaintiff had deliberately worn an orange lily in a part of town unlikely to approve that policy. A hostile and threatening crowd gathered, and in the words of the defense statement, the police sub-inspector gently and quietly, unnecessarily and unavoidably, removed said emblem from the plaintiff, doing her no injury or ever, and in so doing, necessarily committed the set of alleged trespass. The court is contempt. The relevant court, in a much later case, the individual court of the King's Bench Division,
Thank you. against unlawful disturbance.
it has to be recognised also, in the light of that case, that the direct application of Peter Steele Banks is rare. Some commentators have criticised the case on the basis that it does little to underpin freedom of speech. Professors Ewing and Yeo, in their excellent book on civil liberties, 1914 to 1945, describe it as an exceptional decision, an aberration, as asserting a rather spineless principle, and as an eccentric exception that it truly was, whatever dice he may have thought of it when compiling his Oxford lectures on the Constitution in 1885. Reservations have been expressed in the courts about the scope of Peter Steele Banks and whether it could apply in the face of so many common law and statutory restraints on freedom of assembly. Yet, it is significant that the principle of protecting lawful activity has survived so strongly, and in a sense, it calls for reasonableness and common sense in the application of the law. Common sense is needed not only with regard to the prior restraint attempted to be done in Gilbert, but also to the actions of police officers on the spot, and then the decisions whether to prosecute or forward. In a divided decision of the House of Lords in 1999, DPP and Jones, the majority took a benevolent view of a protest on the highway against the closure of Stonehenge, leading to this extrajudicial comment by Lord Cook of Portland. Apart from being an almost exquisite example of the uncertainty of the law in an elementary field, the main interest of DPP and Jones is that it establishes the legitimate use of the highway is not confined to passing and repassing and activities incidental thereto, provided no obstruction or public nuisance is caused, and subject to statutory provisions to the contrary, a peaceful assembly may be found to be a reasonable and lawful use. The decision could be interpreted as an implicit extension of the common law expressed in meeting bill bans, doubtless influenced by the new climate of human rights. Some years before the Human Rights Act, the principle of protecting lawful activity was raised in a very different context from the events of Superman in 1882. On 15th of June 1974, the National Front planned to march to a meeting at Conway Hall in Red Lion Square. This led to strong counter-demonstrating by political colonels. A police cordon was attacked and a riot ensued. Several people were injured and one student at Warwick University died. Lord Justice Scarman was appointed to investigate the public disorder that day, and his report appeared in February 1975. In the course of his report, which examined a variety of important issues, Sir Leslie Scarman, as a general, said that amongst our fundamental human rights, there are without doubt the rights of peaceful assembly and public purpose and the rights of public order and tranquility, except that a balance has to be struck at compromise that would accommodate the exercise of the right of purpose within the framework of public order. In words which could have been inspired by P.G. Milbanks, he went on to say that though the slogans and chants of the National Front were offensive to many people, their march was ordered. Nobody was provoked into any breach of the peace, and the provocation to the counter-demonstrators was not anything that they saw the National Front do, but the mere idea of the emerging nations. The beating of Gilbanks secured express approval in the decision of the Divisional Court in 1999, arising out of events on the steps of Wakefield Cathedral, where three women were, in accordance with an agreement with the police, preaching to passers-by. Initially, no crowd had gathered, but later over 100 people, some of whom were hostile to the women, congregated. And fearing a breach of the peace, the police officer asked the priest to stop. They refused, and they were arrested for breach of the peace. In the subsequent prosecution against one of the women for obstructing the police and executing their duty, the underlying question identified by the court was whether it was reasonable for the police to believe that the appellant was about to cause a breach of the peace. Lord Justice Sedley, giving the judgment of the Divisional Court, and he incidentally had been one of the barristers who appeared before the Starman inquiry, president of the divisional court, he referred to collective authority led by meeting agreements. He looked at the terms of the European Convention, and he held in favor of the appellants and against the police, and declared free speech includes not only the inoffensive, but the irritating, the contentious, the eccentric, the heretical, the unwelcome, and the provocative, provided it is not intended to provoke violence. Freedom only to speak inoffensively is not worth hearing. A number of other cases could be raised, often providing confusing variations in things. The law has been put under strain in an equally confusing variety of sources of public disorder, in industrial disputes and sustained campaigns, such as that undertaken by the Salvation Army or the suffragettes or animal rights protesters, in political movements such as the fascist campaign of the 1930s, through to extreme right-wing movements of the present day, in the context of anti-war protests, including the Boer War over 100 years ago and the Iraq War since 2003, in demonstrations on racial segregation and in sectarian violence, such as that emanating from Northern Ireland. The difficulties faced by the police should not be underestimated. In his report for 1972, for instance, the Metropolitan Police Commission noted the difficulty of maintaining a nice balance between freedom and restriction, spoke of the continual interference with police duty rosters and entitlement to time off, and the constant strain on the tolerance of police officers in dealing with those who seek to achieve political objectives by coercion and force. In its review of Public Order Law in 1985, ahead of the Public Order Act of 1986, the government strongly supported such concerns, but the cost and strain of law enforcement measures we've seen in the Shoreham case to a modification of the principles of immediate legal rights. At the start of this address, I referred to problems which can arise as one step of another record protection. The response to the BFP acquittals was to avert usually possible changes in law on religious hatred. Pressure for further changes continued. In October this year, it reported that senior police officers called for a ban on flagmen on demonstrators covering their faces. And then last week, it reported that the police wished to have new powers to arrest protesters for causing offense through the words which they chant and slogans and their placards and headbands. I have not wished to ignore the highly charged crime of terrorism, but even then, I have urged caution in seeking. But it seems to me that Parliament has in the past 20 years acted too hastily in legislating to combat allegedly new problems in public order, especially in a climate of apprehension sparked by fears of terrorism. There is less and less scope for those alleged to have violated the public order to claim that they are acting lawfully and thus deserving of protection rather than arrest or prosecution. Some might ask, does it matter? In a complex modern society, freedom of expression could be argued should take second place to the maintenance of the Queen's peace and avoidance of intimidation, violence, and damage to property. In parliamentary debates over what became the Public Order Act of 1986, Lord Durham said that nowadays, with universal suffrage and a whole series of bodies to represent views, we shall not put quite the accent that is being put on the traditional assembly, the tradition of marching, the tradition of open air protest, as though the fact that these things are necessary in the past ages is a guide to us today. Yet, we now have the human rights act and the open cases such as meeting human rights. And these remind us that the law should be applied in accordance with reasonableness and common sense. From a democratic standpoint, it should also be recognized that the legitimate expression of views cannot be left simply to parliamentary oversight and the coverage of the media, and the right to demonstrate and protest, albeit subject to many statutory constraints, as well as constraints inherent in the common law, remains a vital safety line. Also in the debates of 1986, Lord Scarman with the experience of 4 major inquiries into public order and what's the events behind him, said that our society has become so complicated and our representative system of government so remote to many fellow citizens that there has to be an alternative way of expressing dissent other than the constitutional way of doing it through representative institutions. This is when, of course, are so important. Insecure, cure, from media and other pressures to ensure their government. And no case is more important to historically than beating the Gilbanks. Perhaps the House of Lords will offer up enough support. Presumption in favour of freedom of assembly. Of course, this is a confused, sometimes murky area of law enforcement, but I would group in favour of that
very much for an extremely informative and enlightening lecture. I think the right end, yeah, and
I think I do. 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 I do big place on the steps in which the laws of terrorism
Professor, what do you think the future holds for freedom of expression? Do you think if the situation will become more as in the old days with less legislative maybe I should phrase my question differently. Do you think that the government will come more and try to seek to limit freedom of expression more and more in the future, say in the next 10 years or so?
You've just painted a picture of half of my life. I am actually one of the card-carrying hippie convoy members that went to Stonehenge. My life as a traveller was outlawed by the Public Order Act. The Beanfield trials took 7 years out of my life, and we went to the High Court to take action against five chief constables that authorised our detention as a major should those individual instances. And we haven't got any change. You either treat me as a major outlaw, or I'm a wrong done by person that can't get redress from the from any of the
which are justified in general terms because of the crimes of terrorism.